Hey, you want that to go?
And our takeouts this morning begin with finance contributor Louise Story from our partner in the New York Times. This just in, okay, the Obama era is over. The person of the year, according to Time magazine, is Ben Bernanke of the Fed.
Well, maybe Obama has already won too many prizes, so they thought...
Possible. Has a Fed chairman ever won person of the year? I wonder.
Didn't Alan Greenspan win once?
Maybe. Possibly. Yeah. Possibly.
You saw, you know, what people are saying about his policies now, Greenspan.
Yeah.
He would not be person of the year. Person non grata of the year. But the reason we asked you here, Louise Story, is actually to talk about a tension that exists between economic statistics that we talk about all the time and the sense of what's actually going on in our lives, the sort of existential index, if you want to say. I mean, you always hear this in political campaigns. One candidate cites, we're doing great, unemployment is up. But then the other candidate says, yeah, but do you feel good, you know, compared to 4 years ago, like Reagan used to do back in the 1980s. There is actually a statistic that attempts to deal with this tension. It's called the Misery Index, and it actually predates my journalistic career. What's it all about?
So this was developed in the late 60s by an economist named Arthur Okun. And what it does is it adds the unemployment rate and the inflation rate, because this was developed during an era where everyone was concerned about stagflation, you know, which is when you'd have high inflation and high unemployment. And it really worked. It tracked the pain of the late 70s, the early 80s. This misery index was high. It went up again in the early 90s. The thing is that it really hasn't gone up as much now because we don't have a high inflation right now. But no one would argue that people aren't miserable right now. So it seems like it's not working right now.
Well, how do we stack up? I mean, if we were to do the misery index around the world, how miserable are we here in the United States?
So Moody's, the rating agency, they put out a new misery index yesterday. And this misery index captures the federal deficits of different countries, and it adds those to the unemployment rate. And what Moody's is arguing is, if you have a huge deficit, the government doesn't have as much power to help solve the problem. And in this new misery index, we're pretty bad. The United States is number 8, just after Iceland. And, you know, Iceland has had a lot of problems.
Yeah.
So Moody's is really raising a lot of questions about sovereign debt and about how much it's going to limit the government's ability to pull us out of this miserable place.
And sovereign debt has an inflationary component as well. So it does relate to the old misery index. All right. Well, how miserable are you this morning? Just a little question for you around the breakfast table here at the Takeaway.
I think we need a new miserable index, though, that measures like gray hair and how little sleep you're getting.
That's good. Oh, my goodness. I'd be down negative territory there. Finance contributor Louise Story, thanks so much.
Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. We have some miserable lawmakers, Todd. They are rushing and feverishly to try and get some work done before they get to go home for the holidays. What's the most important thing they're up to? Is it jobs?
I think they're trying to decide if they're miserable or just moody. I think that might be what they're doing.
Nice,
Thank
Todd.
You very much.
I
Thank
like
you
that.
Very
That's
much.
Good.
All right, we'll get to it. Celestia, jobs, you're right. So we've been describing how federal benefits for jobless Americans have been expiring. So the House today is going to pass $150 billion worth of jobs benefits and spending programs. Half of this is coming from the TARP. So the idea, as Democrats like to say, is to take some money from Wall Street and finally give it to Main Street. So there's money for highway projects, money for COBRA health subsidies, and for unemployment benefits. So the House is going to pass it. The problem is the Senate is not going to. They don't have any time, and they don't have any appetite for $150 billion bill right now. So as a stopgap measure separately, they're going to pass a much smaller job package with just a 2-month extension of COBRA subsidies and unemployment insurance benefits to make sure people can keep getting these benefits since they're expiring. The way they're going to do it is interesting. There's a giant appropriations bill, spending bill for the military. That's troop salaries and equipment that's going to pass. So they're just going to attach this jobs thing to the military bill to make sure it gets through by the time they go home for Christmas.
And the Senate will vote on it before people leave for the holidays?
The Senate will vote on the smaller one. They will not vote on the larger job package. So if that ever passes, it won't be until next year.
And then they'll have to revisit next year. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks.
Stay there, Todd. You might have to be able to consult us on the separation of powers issue in our next story. Patrick Madden joins us, reporter for WAMU down there in Washington. And it's a city story, but it has national implications. Patrick, what's going on in the city council there in Washington, D.C. that has possible congressional implications?
Well, John, yesterday, as you know, the city council voted to legalize same-sex marriage in D.C.
The vote was anticlimactic. This was the second vote on the bill. Pretty much everyone knew what was going to happen, but because D.C. is a federal city and not a state, all laws here are subject to congressional review. So any bill passed by the council goes to both houses of Congress, and they have 30 days to act. Now, it appears unlikely that Congress will intervene, but, you know, if the makeup of the House or the Senate changes in the future, who knows?
Todd, what is the precedent of city political issues becoming national sort of congressional symbols?
Oh, there is a long precedent in Washington, D.C. I can think of issues like needle exchange programs for HIV and AIDS, certainly gun legislation in the district and now gay marriage.
Right.
Anything that's politically charged that the district tries to do, the district is liberal, and when Congress isn't, Congress usually jumps all over it.
So, Patrick Madden, how frustrating is this for city leaders, and do they expect, you say there's not expected to be opposition in Congress, but how worried are they?
Well, I mean, I spoke with David Catania yesterday. He is the D.C. councilman who's sort of been the architect of the bill and sort of spearheaded this effort. And he has already started lobbying members on the Hill. And I spoke with Bishop Harry Jackson, who's leading the effort to stop this bill. And he is also, going to the Hill lobbying federal lawmakers. So I think that's where the fight is going to be over this bill. And there is precedent. Back in 1992, when the district passed one of the first domestic partnership laws, Congress intervened and blocked the city from funding the initiative for about a decade.
All right. Well, Patrick Madden, reporter for WMU, the story there, of course, same-sex marriage being legalized by the city council in Washington, D.C. It moves on to Congress. Let's hear one of those voices you talked to. Thanks, Patrick. Here's Harry Jackson, senior pastor of a church in Maryland.
We want to stop this thing by whatever means necessary. And really, if you think about it, congressional intervention is actually one of the preventatives to domination of the people by the city council.
A voice against same-sex marriage, the city council voted for it. Thanks so much.